So to start with, we have here. I have no idea which corner Victoria is in your screen, so I must stop saying the top right-hand corner. Victoria Richardson's Chief Strategy Officer at AusPayNet. Good day, Victoria.
Good morning, Scott, and I am top right on my screen.
Excellent, or at least got that right. And Simone Joyce, CEO and co-founder of Paper Plane, as well as Chair of FinTech Australia, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right? That's right, Simone, right?
That's right. Good morning.
Phew. And actually, Simone, I know I'm not supposed to say this, but you have beaten me with a tropical background in the back. So thank you very much for getting me on that. Now, also, I have a spiraling circle for Michelle Bullock, who is Assistant Governor, Finance System, Reserve Bank of Australia. And I'm pretty sure Michelle would have been on a panel earlier today. We might just wait for. I'm not going to ask Michelle a question while she's still not appearing on screen. I'm going to ask a completely unscripted question of you. Well, actually, all the questions are unscripted, quite frankly, viewers. So, completely unscripted question for you, Simone. Do you think that the future of payments in Australia is something that we have to work together on? And if it is, or if it's not, who should we be including, and what should we really be doing to make sure we're ready for what's going to happen next, whatever it is?
Oh, so just a small question to start with. Look, we should definitely be focusing on what our payment future looks like in Australia, and there's a number of reasons for that. Obviously, first and foremost, to make sure that the payments services continue to provide the right benefits for everyone interacting with it, whether that's a business getting paid or a person paying a business or even the banks and financial service providers involved. And the reason we need to think about it specifically is I think that you touched on this in your opening talk, Scott. When our previous payment infrastructure was being designed, it was being designed very much through the lens of, well, this is how banks are going to interact with people, and people will get their money from the bank and then give it to someone else. But now, because it's so much more interactive, so much more immediate and predominantly digital, there are so many more people that can be involved in that ecosystem that aren't necessarily a bank and aren't necessarily the traditional players in the space. And I think if we think about that as a overarching structural concept, then we can actually create that ecosystem that you spoke about in your report and just before that is beneficial for everyone. And that's so different and it's really exciting. So who should we be involving in that conversation? Well, certainly banks. Banks as we know them, incumbent banks now, but also challenger banks that might be entering the ecosystem. We should be talking about businesses, big businesses, small businesses, medium businesses, everyone who's getting paid, and what their particular requirements are. And we should be talking to people, so people from all different walks of life, not just people who are really, digitally enabled, but people who live way out in the bush and don't have internet, people who prefer cash under their mattress, people who are still attached to checks. Why and how can we bring them forward? And obviously, we should be talking to fintechs because, in a lot of ways, fintechs are empowered and enabled more than other people to create new products and services within that ecosystem. And if we don't involve fintechs in the process to start with, then two things are probably going to happen. There's going to be some breakout and sitting outside regulation and finding different ways to tack around to make sure that they're coming to market. Buy now, pay later is a really interesting example of that. We're going to see a limit in the number of new products and services that are being produced in Australia, and that might actually put us back and put us behind the world as far as payment innovation goes.
Yeah, thank you for that. It's a really interesting point there about the autonomy of people to choose what they want to do, and you have this choice as to whether you're going to bring the functions that they want to do into the regulatory net. And what happens if you don't? Will they get that opportunity or not? That was a bit unfair, though, what I said, Victoria, wasn't it? Because AusPayNet does create an ecosystem, and you have done for a very long time. And so, I mean, in fact, I'm going to hand the floor to you now to say, Scott, you're just unfair. Or is there something changing now, which means that actually we do need to even take a step further than the steps that AusPayNet have taken to try and include new participants in the way that things work?
Scott, definitely we have to do things differently. And the thing that I took away from your opening speech was that this top down isn't going to work anymore. You know, everything's different. And I like the fact you were talking about the fact we've got to be comfortable with uncertainty. So it would be really naive of me to say, absolutely, AusPayNet's got this, because we do know that the future is certain. I think what's really important is to put some guardrails in place. And I think those guardrails can't be technology specific. The guardrails have to be about ensuring really positive outcomes for people and businesses, to pick up on Simone's point, who are going to use this technology. So just to reflect in terms of what AusPayNet does to support that, you know, AusPayNet holds the rule books for payment systems. And what we're doing now is looking at how can we consciously let non-traditional players into those rule books. So over the last 2 or 3 years, the number of participants in the market has grown, and AusPayNet's membership has grown as well. So there are non-traditional players sitting around the table. And I think it is accelerating. So when that future is already here, you know, Simone mentioned buy now, pay later, we do actually have non-traditional payment methods and finance tools used. And, you know, at the risk of using my small family as an example of one, my 17-year-old son said 2 days ago, "Oh, can I use your driver's license to sign up to Binance?" Like, wait, what? No, it's identity fraud. But, and he said, "Well, my friends are getting 9% interest on their Saturday job." So that's it here. It's really here. And we don't have the regulatory infrastructure for that. And also we have a really helpful message from Joe Longo at ASIC saying, you know, for the time being, you're on your own. So we have this gap already, which people and businesses are navigating.
And that is a good point. For the fear of boring you, Victoria and Simone, it gets back to that.
Impossible.
that line I kept using 3 or 4 years ago when we started the consumer data right is that people are already swimming in dangerous surf. This is only a question of whether we're going to stick up some flags to say where it's safer to swim. We're not going to save them at all by not sticking up any flags. We'll just make it so that we don't have to get wet. So that's a very important point. Now, part of that, Victoria, though, is that those guardrails, I think in the report, I referred to them as standards. And I do that when I use the word standards, I do it in a loose sense, because they can encompass many more things than just technical standards. But they're kind of still fundamental. So is what you're saying. So this uncertainty, but it's got to be a foundation, a language we are all using to create this future. Is that right, Victoria?
I think that's right. I think standards from a technology perspective give you interoperability and scale. I think that's really important. And then I think standards, the other interpretation is, you know, what counts as a good standard, or how should you treat individuals? How do you ensure you give them their money back? And I think both those aspects of standards are really, really important. You know, what standard you hold yourself to. And I think, you know, interestingly, the financial services community through the Royal Commission was, you know, there was a light shone on the standards. What are the community standards? And I think what regulation has to do is hold everyone to those same standards.
Now, what do you think of, I know through some of my work in Europe, Simone, that there sometimes is friction in relation to standards from new entrants to the market, which sometimes I understand and sometimes I don't understand, because an absence of standards also could discourage new entrants, particularly if standards are behind a walled garden or something like that. So how do you think that new startups feel about standards and then being involved in the standards for the payments framework for Australia?
Look, I think, it, as you say, it is important because, to go back to your sports analogies, we've had swimming and we've had people on the football field. If you don't know the rules for engagement on the field, it becomes very difficult to be a valuable player on that field and for your customers or users to understand how they interact with you. And that could be a feeling of, as Victoria mentioned, protection. I know that if something goes wrong, I have these protections behind me. Or it could even just be understanding the service that you're providing. If no one can understand what it is because it's so far out of the standards, it may take a long time for actually that go-to-market ramp to get to velocity. I think you mentioned Europe, but I think that there's an interesting case study of the US as well, where instead of going through the regulatory approach for certainly their open data framework, it was really market-led. Companies like Plaid, and I know that there's another couple over there, but Plaid comes to mind, they really created that open banking network from a market-led and a product-led perspective. We're coming back at it from, okay, let's create, we've got a data standards body that is creating the standards of interaction and the standards of data that should be communicated, which means that we've had a slower kickoff, but maybe we'll actually see the adoption go faster. And maybe that means that walled gardens won't be as prevalent here because it hasn't been designed from one product out. So I think that's really important. But I also think that the basic frameworks that we have in play at the moment, the e-payments code is a classic example. ASIC's undergoing an ongoing review. It's been at least a year and a half since we started that, and there was a little COVID interruption in there. And I think it's appropriate that that's been held back a little bit in line with what happens with the what Treasury does with your report, Scott. But how that e-payments code will actually then be adopted? Will it be, as you recommended, adopted as a piece of legislation as opposed to a recommended way of operation? We'll wait and see, but it'll be interesting to see what happens with that next to even create more of that standardisation of operation, I suppose.
It's interesting, Simone, that the United States is finally moving to creating regulations for open banking through the Dodd-Frank Act, and who would have thought I would have said that word again? I couldn't believe that. That legislation seems to haunt my entire career. But it is interesting because the what America might choose to do in relation to a system where the standards are already in place, whilst trying to ensure there is uniform access to the rights, is going to be very, very interesting. Mind you, never underestimate America and trying to solve difficult problems. We'll see what that happens.
Scott, but, do you think that the Visa Plaid potential merger / acquisition had something to do with, I guess, hurrying up that approach to formalise the open data standards in the US? Or do you think that was just a incidental? Because the antitrust laws crushed that deal. So I'm just wondering if that had anything to do with how the government started rethinking about what their open banking standards were.
Gosh, we can tell how unscripted we are because you just hit me with a question six levels above my pay.
Can I add another perspective, Simone? My understanding is also that open banking and the benefits of it worked if you're in the States, if you're a customer of a big bank, because they've got the relationships with the Plaids and the Xeros. But it didn't work for you if you were a customer of a credit union, because the credit unions couldn't have those relationships with those intermediaries. So I think that's one of the drivers as well, is how do you deliver this cross-economy benefit? And in a market where it's user pays, so I think it was that inequity they were looking to address. Maybe you've got your own answer as well now, Scott.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to answer any of your questions, but I'm going to dodge the question completely because Jackie has completely saved me by turning up on the screen. So I'd like to introduce everyone, Jackie Kalman, the Head of Payments Industry and Engagement at ANZ Banking Services. Welcome, Jackie. I'm so tempted to throw you straight into a question when you've just turned up on the screen, but I'm going to slightly tilt it because Victoria made a really good point there, and save my bacon because I didn't want to answer that question because I'm supposed to be the one asking the questions. But the really good point was around inclusion and who has access to these things. Now, inclusion and access are similar, but they're not the same, and they do ripple through the payments industry and the banking industry in all sorts of ways. And they get all sorts of labels as well when a particular aspect of inclusion is considered. But when, Jackie, when you're looking at payments and the payments ecosystem, is there anything about the future in relation to inclusion of either businesses or people that concerns you with the way that we meet the challenges that are coming for us?
Yeah, sure. So I think it's a really important issue. And like you say, has very different, a number of different kind of ways we can cut it. But inclusion, whether you're talking about inclusion, access, they're related. So I think the fact that, you know, historically, and as you said earlier in your keynote, Scott, that, you know, this is, payments have in the past been a banking thing, and there's the regulation and protections have been largely designed around banks and, you know, payments, making payments through banks, the liability has been with banks. And so as we look to open access and include new business models and new players and innovation that really has the opportunity to benefit customers, we have to look at the protection side and how you bring those people into the tent. Means you do need to have rules that apply. So you do need to have, you know, there's that concept of same risk, same rules. I think as we get that, and I know it sounds kind of funny when we're talking about things like inclusion and access, to then start talking about rules and risk and regulation, but I think they're very, very much related. And you know, in the past, we've relied on prudential licensing for, you know, new entrants to banking, but now that we have new entrants to payments, we need to have that same concept applied. Where if you're doing a similar thing, the same rules apply, and then you're on a level playing field, and really. Any business model that meets those requirements can be included. Any participant that meets those requirements can be included. And I'm talking about inclusion and access of participants to the network as opposed to financial inclusion for consumers and customers, which is, again, slightly different. And we can, I feel like it's a slightly different point or conversation. So, but yeah, that's what I would say about inclusion is that if we have a level playing field, and as Simone said earlier, which I heard as I was fiddling with the technology, that, you know, you need to know the rules to join the field. That's exactly right. So to be at the table, to be on the field, those same rules have to apply.
Yes, I forgot to thank Simone for yet another Simone addition to that analogy that I've been using. I think I've got multiple chapters now, Simone. But speaking of these rules of the game, Simone, now that's another issue really close to heart to entrants and the possibility of being excluded because... well, in some cases, people would say we don't really know why we've been excluded. Tell us what you think in relation to that issue of exclusion.
Okay. I think you're referring to what fintechs would call debanking. So
yes, I am.
It was interesting, actually, in the lead up to this, Jackie and I had a conversation about, well, should we call it debanking or should it be something else? And I think that is so indicative of the fact that this is such a complex issue to address, and there's no one reason for this to happen. And there's no one point of blame or fault either. I think that if you wanted to assign blame, and what we're talking about is having the services of both banking and the ability to make and create payments removed from you as a company. Now, obviously, that's very impactful, and there's a number of different sectors of companies that affects crypto and payments really come to mind. But obviously, if you've had that service removed or you can't have access to that service, you can't operate. You have nothing to operate with. And I think that what's happening here is that we don't have those clear rules set out to protect banks to say, yes, this is a I feel comfortable here, and I know exactly what the operating standards are, and it's clear what our framework is to engage with this company. And then on the other side of that, you've got predominantly fintechs who are going, well, we feel like we've met all the rules, but maybe they're implied rules, or maybe there's no clear guardrails, that word again, to say that we're operating in that space. Now, I think some of the recommendations that you made, Scott, around having licenses, so a payment initiation license versus a settlement license, all the way up to an ADI license, will be helpful. But they're also, and this has happened in Canada, they brought those licenses in, but there wasn't anything under that to say, once you've got a license, you get one, two, and three. So I think we're at step one. We've got the conversation happening, which will mean that banks can feel more comfort with interacting, knowing that they're within their safe and regulated guidelines. And fintechs can come up to standards and to tick boxes and say, yes, we've got all of these things and we've got this piece of paper. But what's next? Piece of paper. It's a digital thing, obviously. But what's next? What happens after that? How does that ongoing relationship work without making things too prescriptive or too onerous for either party to continue to operate? And look, there's a whole other space of this debanking issue that deals with, the ACCC issues and competition issues. But I really think that if we can focus in to start with on at least that basic framework, and AUSTRAC has got a role to play there as well as a few other regulators, we can start to actually maybe untangle this knotty issue from the ground up.
Can I just jump in there and agree with Simone? Because I think it's those two layers. So you've just mentioned AUSTRAC there, Simone, and there, there wouldn't be inquiries about this if there was absolute certainty for the banks about what the obligations were. And there's, through the Australian Payments Council, we've led a big piece of work. The lens was combating financial crime. And that's not to suggest for any minute that fintechs are involved in financial crime, but it was a safe lens through which to look at what the requirements were. And they are not clear. And they're so unclear that to some extent, banks can't work together to combat financial crime. So they know that there's a bad actor and they can't share information about that actor because of the anti-money laundering regime. So I think there needs to be absolute clarity around that. You can't, there can be no flow down if you don't know where the buck stops at the top. And I think that has to be a huge part of regulatory reform. It has to be absolutely clear for the banks. And then it's easy for the banks to have a really transparent conversation with organisations that want to use their banking services. Here are the guardrails. But I think that has to be fixed. I think if you just create an electronic money licence, as an example, without fixing that top bit, you won't get the outcomes that everyone's looking for.
100%, which is why I think, Scott went from that clarity and regulation and coordination amongst regulators straight then to licensing. It all is connected.
Thank you for jumping into my defense there, Jackie. That was good. In fact, that issue of, I think that issue demonstrates the dynamic nature of the complex system. Because if you pull any thread in relation to debanking, you will not unravel everything. You'll make some threads tighter. It is a genuinely hard thing to solve. But I agree with you, Victoria. That doesn't mean, that doesn't mean you don't solve it. But it's what the one thing that generally makes it a complex system. It makes it quite clear. Now, part of this point, and I nearly got to it earlier, but I was massively distracted by Jackie turning up. I was about to ask you, Victoria, a question that because it got onto your driver's license story, which I'm still in my own family trying to work out what the consequences of that are for me right now, is what is the role of digital forms of identification in the way that our payments future unfolds? Do we need to have something better, or what would our future be like if we didn't have any digital equivalent to what you described?
Uh, So the short answer is yes. The slightly longer answer is, you know, if you go way back, 2005, Kim Cameron in his Laws of Identity, and he talked about the fact that the internet is absent a native identity layer. And it's true, you know, more than 15 years on, it's still true. And if we think about all the future forms of payments, be it the very near future in terms of third-party payment initiation through the consumer data right, or open finance or decentralized finance, everyone needs to know who everyone is dealing with. And until we fix that, we won't have the safe environment that everyone has sort of clarity to transact in. And I think that's a fundamental thing to fix. I think what's happened in the last sort of 5 or 6 years is that, you know, we've had forms of digital identification through social logins, and at the risk of using jargon, you know, in that web 2.0, people have engaged with content largely through big platforms. And I think as we go into web 3.0, there won't be those big platforms. It will be possible for individuals to engage with content in a much more decentralized way, which was actually the way that Tim Berners-Lee first thought about the internet. Until we fix the identity layer, none of that will be possible. It is true that you'll be safer transacting through a platform controlled by somebody. So, yeah, a big yes, we need to fix it about 20 years ago.
Right. Okay, so it wasn't my fault. It was the fault of the person who wrote the previous report 20 years ago. Thank you. Welcome, Michelle. I have been saving a question for you, Michelle, and I have already introduced you, Michelle, so I'm not talking to you without introducing you. Okay, I've been saving this one because this is the one I'm sure people want me to ask all of you. Right, you talked about the future, Scott. You haven't mentioned a particular word. I'm not talking CBDCs. We've had that. You've already talked to that. What is the role of crypto assets, cryptocurrencies, and stable coins in the future of payments? I'm not asking you to predict the prices of Bitcoin in the future, Michelle, but in your experience or your expertise, what do you see the role of these sorts of digital assets in our future?
I personally don't think that crypto, and I'm not calling them currencies because they're not currencies, I don't think they have a role in the payment system going forward. I think stable coins potentially do have some potential roles, but I don't think crypto does in its purest form, which is where all of this started. But like all good things, it's generated a whole discussion and it's generated a whole series of innovations which will lead somewhere. But of itself, this idea that cryptocurrencies will become the new mode of payment, that's just not going to happen in my view. Stable coins might have a role, and that depends a little bit on what happens, I think, with central bank digital currencies, because if central banks issue digital currencies, if this does become a thing, then I do wonder what it is that stable coins will give you that central bank digital currencies don't give you and more. So I'm a little skeptical, and my colleague Tony Richards gave a speech, I think it was last week, who basically similarly skeptical about the role of crypto going forward, which generated lots and lots of heat from people who thought he was wrong, and I'm sure my comments will be jumped on the same.
Thank you, Michelle. I think you were quite clinical in part of that description, because you were saying in relation to payments, and we indeed are talking about payments rather than questions of investment or those sorts of things. I just want to make that clear, because if anyone's going to jump on you, I think they should make sure they're doing it for the right comment. But surely some of this panel have another view, a different view, or want to share that view. How do you see the future of payments with the interaction of crypto assets or stable coins? Anyone have a view?
I can take a little bit of a view, and I think that I can certainly see where Michelle is coming from, saying that crypto won't be a payment vehicle. It doesn't meet one of the basic three things that you require as a currency in a payment. But I do think that there will be those things that happen outside of how we think traditionally about payments. So I think that driven by services that allow merchants to pull in a crypto gateway as a payment mechanism on their e-com, or have a QR code at POS that allows people to move money from their crypto wallet into the merchant's crypto wallet, that's happening and it will continue to happen, but potentially it won't happen into the foundation ecosystem of our payment infrastructure, but I think it will happen. And I think that the way that that people think about payments, that will feel like a payment to them. And for all intents and purposes, they have exchanged thing of value for another thing that they wanted, and that will be a payment. So whilst I probably agree it's probably more appropriate to have a stable coin or a CBDC as a feature of our payment infrastructure, potentially crypto will continue to happen outside of that as people exchange for goods and services.
Thank you.
I agree with that, Simone, and I think the worry there, though, is that it may not be clear to somebody transacting which is which. And, you know, the stablecoin or the CBDC, there's a stability there. And there would need to be a stability there, I think, to make it bank grade. And so the question then is, well, what if something goes wrong on the other end? In the crypto world, but we can't actually control that. So, I mean, it's my view that there will be stablecoin and or central bank digital currency, and that the banks probably do have a role to play in that. To quote Senator Hume, it's not just a fad, but there are definite questions around regulation. Is the regulation fit for purpose? And is this money? Is it securities? So a lot of questions still to be asked, what the role is for banks. But I think it's not going away. And if we sort of say, well, it's just something that happens along the edges, I think that ends up being a lot riskier than the opportunity to have, you know, from a cross-border perspective as well, to, you know, really kind of shake up the correspondent banking and a lot of the friction that's there. You could have real time cross border without any of the overnight and you know, the reconciliation. So there's a lot of opportunity, a lot of opportunity there.
Look, can I just jump in and clarify? I mean, your point about, I was talking about payments. I'm not saying that they're not going to be around. They are going to be around, but you know, if you're a business and you're paying your staff in Australian dollars and you're receiving revenue in Australian dollars, why are you going to want to take for payment something that its value may be double or it may be half? I mean, it's some people might have philosophical reasons for wanting to do this, but it does seem to me that it's a reasonably tough ask. Having said that, you know, clearly for investment purposes, if you're into that, I certainly wouldn't be putting all my eggs in one basket. But you know, some people want to have a little bit of a gamble there. Fine, but payments, I just don't see it.
You know what? I think that when one of the original exchanges first established Coinbase over in the US, their founder came out with this big thing about Bitcoin's going to be the way of the future. Everyone's going to want to pay in Bitcoin. And it never happened. Well, certainly not in the first early part and not to the extent that he thought it was. So they had to wind all the way back from it. So I agree. The bits around it, it gives me a headache just trying to think about what I'd have to tell the accountants about. What do you even put on you? How do you pay GST on the fact that you've actually doubled what you took the payment for in the first place? But I still think it's going to happen and it is happening. But yes, it's certainly a different way of thinking about doing business. That's for sure.
Victoria, before I jump on a word that Jackie used to move to the next sort of topic, did you have anything you want to offer in relation to crypto assets or crypto tokens?
Just, I think it's already happening. And to go back to what you said in some of your very early opening comments, we've got to be comfortable with our ambiguity and along the lines of, you know, never say never. banks haven't always been here. You know, the risk of giving an oversimplified version of the history of money. You know, we've gone from all sorts of things, including cocoa beans and big stones lost in water. So there isn't some sort of universal, my mind can't latch on to some universal truth that says it's got to be the central banks, it's got to be central bank money. I think central banks have provided a massively important role and provided protection, and they've been part of something really important. I reserve the right in a way to come back in maybe 100 years and say, okay, that was a point in history, but given new technology and new trust networks, might something else be possible? Well, maybe, probably.
Thank you, Victoria. And if we are allowed to reserve the right to come back in 100 years, I would like to reserve that right now, because that would be very handy.
We've all got that right. We'll all give one another that right.
Jackie, you used a very important phrase, and this probably will be the last discussion point we will have. You used the phrase cross-border. And this is, of course, fundamental to what our future holds, because money doesn't stop at our border. So, Jackie, what do you see as the future of payments in relation to cross-border transfers, or what sort of issues do we need to actually confront and overcome in making this work?
Yeah, so I think we hear a lot about real-time cross-border, and it's, for me, is more about the 24/7 than the real-time. And I think when we have things like NPP in Australia and others globally, to be able to connect them and have that smooth transition so that it really is instant. And even if it's not instant, it's, you don't have those cutoffs at the end of the day where you have to wait until the following day to sort things out. And I think also there's an opportunity to change the way we look at finality of settlement. So, you know, today we have the double accounting standard, and there's a whole process that goes on through correspondent banking of ensuring the funds are there, and you have the clearing and you have the settlement. And so there are opportunities with perhaps stable coins, you know, distributed ledgers to bring that to an instant and tied together settlement, clearing and settlement together. So you combine that concept, I guess, with the real-time payments, or the 24/7 payments, I think it's exciting. And then you go to, though, you're sending data all over the world, payment data all over the world, and it brings back to the, well, where's the authentication? How do you know who the individual is? And could you actually have a internationally recognized identity? We haven't even been able to manage to do it nationally, but I think those are the questions that come up then.
Michelle, how do you look at the future of cross-border payments?
Cross-border payments has been one of the perennial issues. When I first entered payments like 25 years ago, cross-border was something that people were stressed or considering then. What can we do better? We're still considering it. So I'm actually reasonably hopeful that this new technology might provide some way of addressing this issue. And I think stable coins here potentially provide quite a good use case. You know, also we are doing experiments in central bank digital currencies here. So the Reserve Bank's involved in a project called Project Dunbar. And what that's involved with doing with a few other central banks and the Bank for International Settlements is we're looking at, can you have a platform that would allow exchange of central bank digital currencies issued by the various jurisdictions that would allow this all to happen really quickly and therefore go back. So banks could use it basically to clear and settle, to Jackie's points. You could do it really quickly using central bank digital currencies. Now, this is just a pilot. It's got years. But the other thing I think is that a lot of countries at the moment have fast settlement systems. Fast payment settlement systems. So there's actually a really promising thing with technology that's already here, which is, can we just link them up? Now, there's a whole lot of other issues associated with that as well, to do with AML and so on. But at least in concept, you have all of these countries with these fast settlement services. And if we could find a way to link them up, that actually is something that's already there. You could do it. So I'm actually reasonably confident that in terms of technology and doability, we can solve the cross-border problem. I think the biggest issue is going to be the AML-CTF stuff, because that's going to be the thing that's going to put the friction in the wheels. That would be my view.
Thank you. Victoria, you were nodding there.
It brings it back down to the identity, doesn't it? It brings it back to identity, which has to be digital in this digital world. And it was cross-border as well. Specifically, we're looking at under the Payments Council and combating financial crime. I mean, it is really hard for organisations to share information about overseas bad actors. And the way to solve that is to have, you know, better regulatory regimes and better mechanisms for giving people some kind of consistent identifier that they use and having strong authentication around that.
Thank you. And Simone, could you give us the final comment of the panel in relation to...
I think that everyone has made a very valid point about the AML and the KYC. I think that ultimately there is two separate streams of thought going on. It's, as Jackie and Michelle talked about, the bank settling between each other, but then there's also the people who are sending the money. So a person is sending money to another person, and bringing a layer of transparency and an understanding of the final costs involved, I think, is going to be so valuable once all of those foundational things are in place. That's why companies like Wise, used to be TransferWise, were so successful, because they created that layer of transparency and cost assurance. I think if that can be baked in by design into the actual pipes, that will be fabulous for everyone involved. I'm also so interested to see how our fast payment network connects to other ones, knowing that ours is built by Swift. I think the US and Canada are both Vocalink, and I think the UK was Vocalink as well. I'm not 100% sure, but once they're all connected up and together, I think that there's going to be so many other things that we can do, and create a truly global payments infrastructure would be super cool.
I don't think I can round off the panel with anything better than the word super cool. So I think I'd like to thank you very, very much, Michelle, Jackie, Simone, and Victoria, for giving us your time, your thoughts, your insights.